This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Each October, cranberry growers don their waders and brave chest-high water to corral millions of deep-red cranberries into waiting trucks. The annual harvest is as quintessential a New England scene as fall foliage. Massachusetts is the second largest producer of the cranberries, which eventually land on Thanksgiving tables around the country. But behind that postcard image and the holiday staple is a lot of critical science that growers need to keep up on. In particular, climate change poses a serious challenge to cranberry cultivation in southern New England. WCAI's South Coast reporter Brian Morris takes us to the UMass Cranberry Station in East Wareham, where research on this iconic berry has been ongoing for more than 100 years, helping local cranberry growers understand the best available science for maintaining strong, healthy yields.
Carolyn DeMoranville has been leading a team of scientists and researchers at the UMass Cranberry Station for the last 30 years. The goal here is to improve on anything and everything related to cranberry production.
Anything that would be involved in producing the crop, from nutrient management to water management to pest management.
DeMoranville says there's always been a unique relationship between local growers and the scientists who work at the station.
Growers are welcome to come anytime. We have a very open door policy. Growers walk in with problems. We also set up planned workshops where we have specimens for them to look at, or they can bring their own.
And the cooperation extends further. In addition to doing research on its own 11 acres of bogs, DeMoranville says the station also conducts studies on growers' bogs, which have different soil characteristics. Climate change is another issue that looms large for the cranberry industry.
But what it's turning out to be that's more interesting and more concerning is some of the extreme weather events that seem to be accompanying climate change, the large volume rainstorms.
The plants also go through a dormant period in the winter, and she says this could potentially be affected by climate change.
That dormant period has to have a certain number of cold hours to reset the plant so that then in the spring, when that bud begins to grow, it will flower normally.
The Cranberry Station's lab facilities are in a small building across from DeMoranville's office. Marty Sylvia's entomology lab is near the end of the hallway.
Come next door and see my bees.
Marty's our entomology technician.
Cranberries are pollinated by bees, and bee populations are in decline overall. That's a concern for people like Marty Sylvia. She brings out a display case containing about 100 bee carcasses. Each is meticulously labeled and mounted in rows that look like a formation of miniature bombers.
We also look at disease and virus and all the problems that the bees are having as part of colony collapse. And it's not just honeybees. The native bees are also having these problems.
So the health of the bees indirectly determines sort of the health of the cranberries, correct?
Indeed. So that's why we're relying on the honeybees, is because if your native bees are compromised, you have to bring in more honeybees to pollinate your crop.
The cranberry station works with growers of all sizes, from smaller operations with 20 acres or less to larger growers who cultivate 100 to 200 acres. The AD Makepeace Company is the world's largest cranberry growing operation, with 2,000 acres of bogs in the Wareham area. This year, they'll harvest an estimated 35 million pounds of cranberries. On a recent sunny November morning, wader-clad workers stand waist-deep in a sea of red berries at a Makepeace bog. John Porter is director of research and development for the company.
Right now, we're looking at the loading operations. Previous to this, we flooded the bogs and brought picking machines out to our bogs to basically knock the berries off the vines. The berries then float to the surface of the water. They're corralled using...
Porter is describing the wet harvesting method. Cranberries harvested this way end up in sauces, juices, and things like craisins. Porter, a biologist, used to work at the UMass Cranberry Station, which was called the Cranberry Experiment Center at one time. So he's been on both sides of the fence, both as a scientist and now as a grower. Back in his truck, he says he still turns to the station for guidance.
When I'm trying to find the answers for how to deal with various issues, I'm often reading the literature that was written by personnel at the Cranberry Experiment Station. Right now we're about to build 140 acres of new bogs, and I am reading very closely the best management practices written by Carolyn DeMoranville to figure out how we should build these new bogs.
For the last 100 years, area cranberry growers have maintained a productive working relationship with the UMass Cranberry Station. That spirit of cooperation has paid off with improved results for many cranberry farms. But the industry as a whole still faces important challenges. Tackling those challenges will determine how the iconic red berry, long a fixture at Thanksgiving tables everywhere, may fare in the years to come. For WCAI, I'm Brian Morris in Wareham.
The challenges facing cranberries and their growers are a familiar topic for my guest today. You could say it's in her blood. Susan Playfair's great-grandparents were both cranberry growers. She grew up on their bogs, but then, as many young people do, she wandered away and built a varied career in finance and fashion. She's come back to her roots in a new book about the long history and uncertain future of the cranberry. It's called America's Founding Fruit, The Cranberry in a New Environment. Susan Playfair, welcome to Living Lab.
Well, it's delightful to be here. Thank you very much, Heather.
I have a photo here of you, I believe, on your great-grandfather's cranberry bog. You obviously have a deep family connection to cranberries. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I grew up being quite close to my great grandparents, and there were cranberries grown in my great grandmother's family, and cranberries grown in my great grandfather's family, and then he also managed bogs for a lot of the Eatmore growers at that time, and that was a cooperative before Ocean Spray.
Did you ever consider a career in cranberries? You've had a very varied career in finance and fashion. Cranberries never factored in.
Cranberries never factored in, but I think I like to write about people who work outside, and I think I remember having a job once in New York, and I kept thinking there must be a way to get outside and get paid for it. So that may be part of the fascination. It just dawned on me when I look back at that.
So how did you then decide to kind of circle back to your roots and end up writing this book about cranberries?
Well, I've always, possibly because of my great grandparents, I've always really been interested in how this whole industry worked. And then in the town I grew up in, which was Duxbury, Massachusetts, why we had a number of people who actually worked for Ocean Spray. And so I just always wondered, well, what happens? And then I began to, I should add, I'm married to a scientist, although I am not a scientist. And so I got to go to a lot of talks on climate change very early on. And then I began to kind of wonder, well, here's this iconic fruit that's so much a part of our history, especially in New England. And, how is it going to change? Will we lose it at some point as the climate changes? So I think those two things got wrapped together in my thinking.
Well, let's go back to the basics with cranberries. You write that the cranberry is one of three cultivated fruits native to North America. There are really only three?
Only three cultivated: blueberries, Concord grapes, and cranberries. And I think cranberries, in a sense, are the most, I keep using this word iconic, but they're the one that we really have associated with so much of our history. For a cranberry to grow, it takes unique conditions, and we just happen to have them here. And I suppose you can say it started 15,000 years ago when the glaciers were retreating and they carved out kettle basins, and then over time, those kettle basins began to fill with whatever vegetation blew into them, and then little by little, they became an ideal medium for growing this little red berry.
So bogs are, as you're alluding to, a really unique ecosystem, and there's not a lot else that's well-suited to grow there the way that cranberries are. They kind of have carved out a very special niche.
Exactly. So you have the perfect conditions in Massachusetts, parts of Maine, New Jersey, Wisconsin, Oregon, and Washington. And that's only the cranberry that we're used to, the large red berry that we use in our cranberry sauce. And
there are other varieties?
Well, there's a very tiny, I'll give you the Latin name, which is Oxycoccus berry, which is it actually is native to England and Ireland, the British Isles, among other places. And so it's pea-sized, and as I understand, it's even more acidic than our cranberries. So when the pilgrims came to this country and they saw this red berry that is really our Vaccinium macrocarpon, which is the red berry that we're used to, they were afraid to do anything with it at first, because even though they were used to the small berry in their country, they didn't even think this was similar. So,
I mean, I think it's really fascinating in our very globalized world at this point to think about there being a plant that grows in so few areas. I mean, that is endemic to such a small area, and even having been transported a little bit by human beings, we're still talking about a very tiny, very tiny area where you find cranberries.
Now, you can, I should explain, you can grow cranberries in upland areas. It's a different type of cultivation, because you don't have the peat base that we're talking about that you find in where the native berries grow. But you still have to have the right amount of, you have to have a chill factor, which becomes critical when we get into talking about a changing climate.
In case you're just joining us, my guest is Susan Playfair. She's talking about her new book, America's Founding Fruit, The Cranberry in a New Environment. I want to go back to, again, it's very early days, and how Native Americans used the cranberry. Were they cultivating the cranberry, or is this something that they were simply harvesting what was naturally growing in the already occurring bogs?
No, they were not cultivating it. They would go out and pick it, and they controlled their picking very well, because there were only certain days when the season opened, and no one was allowed to pick before that or after that.
So they actually had essentially management and regulations about harvesting cranberries.
Exactly. And so they used it for a number of different reasons. They used it as a poultice for wounds, from mostly from arrows, and then, you know, as we're all familiar with, you know, this treatment that people have been doing for years, which is drinking cranberry juice or eating cranberries to ward off urinary tract infections. They made a cranberry tea for the same purpose. Mm. And they also made a sort of poultice that they would put on what is in literature that's still is still available to us. Why they would put it on cancers. Now, I'm not entirely sure that cancers really were what we think of as cancers, or if they were more boils, but apparently it worked. And we know that Lewis and Clark, when they were on their expedition, believed that cranberries had medicinal powers, because at different times they made a point, when someone had come down with a fever, to go out and try to find cranberries to treat that person. So the one thing, of course, we're probably mostly familiar with is using cranberries for scurvy, which is, I suppose, kind of obvious, because it was hard for us to get the limes that the British ships used to carry on board, but it was pretty easy in this area to get cranberries. And what a captain did is he told each of his seamen that the first thing they had to do when they got up on deck was to line up, and he would feed them a tablespoonful of cranberries, and then they could start doing whatever they were supposed to be doing on board.
Yikes. Spoonful of cranberries, not very sweet. I actually, when I was very young, actually had repetitive UTIs, ended up having some surgery for it. And one of my post-surgical prescriptions from my urologist was 8 ounces of cranberry juice, unsweetened, every single night. And I don't know how long he intended me to do it, but I think my mom had me do it for 3 or 4 years till I was probably 8 or so years old. It was just that bedtime routine. And it's fascinating that the science is really bearing out these So these old sources of knowledge.
So do you still drink cranberry juice, or did it turn you off?
I have to say, for a long time, it did turn me off. I mean, it's not a sweet juice, but no, it's typically around our house. I wouldn't say we're religious about it, but it's a hard sell for little kids, and I imagine it could be a hard sell for those sailors as well if you didn't have the captain there saying eat the cranberries.
You had no choice. It was that, or you were in the drink.
You know, we have all these sweetened cranberry products now, like craisins and sweetened juices.
Yeah.
If you add that sugar in, do they still have the same health benefits? Do we know?
They seem to have the same health benefits because that's a matter of going back and looking at the formation of the cell and various other things. But what they do then is, of course, they start to take on negative health values as you put too much sugar in. And I think that the cranberry industry has become very aware of that because we have a huge epidemic in this country, especially with obesity and diabetes. And so you now can find products on the market like Lean Crans, which the Deekus company is doing in Wareham and Carver, and a number of products that are sweetened dried berries, but they have far less sugar in them. And in the back of the book that I've just written, why you'll find a recipe for making your own cranberry juice where you can put in as little sugar as you want.
So how much cranberry do you eat or drink on a daily basis at this point?
Well, it depends on the day. We tend to, you know, I wrap my poor husband into this. We tend to have dried cranberries in either cereal or oatmeal, probably five days a week. And then I would say we have, I have cranberry juice every day at lunch practically. And then in the evening, we might have a cranberry dish, I'd say probably 3-4 times a week, not necessarily the entree. Now, that might be a little extreme by most people.
More cranberries than most, perhaps. I mean, I think it's become really popular in the past few years to designate things superfoods when they, you know, you can find a healthful quality to many foods, but cranberries certainly have gotten lumped into that category of superfoods. Do we understand at a scientific level what makes them a superfruit, what makes them so helpful?
Well, I spoke to a number of research scientists working on cranberries, and hopefully I have this correct, but there are several different issues here. One is that you have something called proanthocyanidins, which are shortened as PACS. But anyway, they basically are blockers of bacteria, so that and a lot of that has to do with the cell formation. And my understanding is that whereas as many cells fit together kind of like gears, that the cranberry cell doesn't fit together. So it acts as almost a blocker or a barrier or a wall, so that bacteria have a harder time getting to an outer wall, or an inner wall, I guess it is.
But getting to the human cell.
Getting to the human cell, exactly.
Fascinating. You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest is Susan Playfair. We'll talk more after a short break. You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest is Susan Playfair, author of the new book, America's Founding Fruit, The Cranberry in a New Environment. Susan Playfair, we were talking about the healthful qualities of cranberries and the fact that going all the way back to Native Americans, there was an understanding at some level that these were almost a medicinal fruit. When did they start to maybe change a little bit? I mean, they're part of our Thanksgiving tradition, not necessarily because we think they're good for us. When did they become part of our culinary tradition?
I'm not sure exactly how to answer that, because the Native Americans, the Indians in this area, did use them also as fruit because they of their keeping quality, and so they would take them and they would make a so-called pemmican, which is that they would take the fat of meats that they had shot, basically, and they would chop fine some of the cranberries and mix it together, and that way the idea was in the winter, when the fruit weren't that available, they would have a pretty balanced diet by pulling out this very fatty, suety meat with cranberries in it. Mm-hmm. So it was used as a food stuff at that time. And then I think my understanding is that the same Native Americans taught our early settlers how to make a cranberry, or it was called a cranberry, because if you see the plant as it starts to flower, it's the blossom goes up and then goes down, so it really looks like the head of a crane. Mm. But so they taught the settlers how to make, quote, craneberry tea. And I think when you really began to get a real sense of it as a proclaimed food was during President Lincoln's time, because he was the one who actually made Thanksgiving an official holiday.
Right.
So up to that time, I mean, there are many instances of the berry being used in food, and there are records of cranberry desserts being served to the first president of Harvard University when he was installed, and that General Grant's men were served, they were provided right. with cranberries. And then before that, Benjamin Franklin there's a writing showing that he had asked his daughter to send him cranberries when he felt homesick. So it does. There are all little tidbits going throughout history that have been recorded as to the cranberry's role.
Do we know if cranberries were part of the first Thanksgiving?
I doubt they were, to be honest. Because at that time they didn't really know. They were a little fearful of this berry because they didn't really know what it was.
Another one of those distortions, I guess, of our sense of what a traditional Thanksgiving
exactly.
is was not necessarily what it was like.
Well, first time around, I think Lincoln did when he proclaimed the first Thanksgiving. I think he did include cranberry sauce.
Why do you think cranberries deserve the term our founding fruit? What makes them important enough to be considered as a factor in the founding of our country?
Well, I don't know of documentation showing that the other two native cultivated fruit were used that much in early by the early founders of the country. And so we have documentation showing that cranberries were. I guess that's part of it.
How much has cranberry cultivation and harvest changed over the past 200 years? I mean, there's been a lot of technological innovation. But if you go down and watch cranberries being harvested, in a lot of ways, it looks kind of old-fashioned still.
Mm-hmm. It is. it's interesting that we're on the Cape because, of course, this is where the cranberries were first cultivated. And at that time, of course, picking was all done by hand. And I believe it was 1890 when the first hand scoop came into existence. And then after that, you've had all these little developments along the way. And of course, now, well, going back to the wet harvest, I mean, the whole concept of dry harvesting and selling only fresh fruit has been replaced by flooding the bogs, which you've probably all seen, which is this beautiful fall tradition that we've come to expect in this part of the country, where you see the red berries floating on a blue surface.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. I actually live maybe a 5-minute walk from a set of bogs in Falmouth, and it's a family tradition. You can hear the machinery start
yes.
going, and everybody has to go down and watch the bogs being harvested. And I always, shoot off what would have been a roll of film, taking just so many photos of that beautiful scene and the guys walking around in their chest waders and essentially netting up the berries to
yes,
then be
right.
sucked well, you, up you, into a truck.
You have a great attitude because I mean, some people who buy new homes that are around cranberry bogs find the sounds really disturbing. So that's wonderful.
No, I've got three young kids and everybody loves it. There's a little bit of ear holding if you're right next to the truck because we have to go right up next to the truck and watch the berries being sucked up, almost vacuumed up out of the water and then spit into the back of the truck and bouncing everywhere. And then we have a little family tradition because after they're done harvesting, they always leave plenty of cranberries along the edges of the bogs. And we literally walk down with a fishing net and just scoop up.
Great.
I think we must have gotten 3 or 4 pounds this year on a single trip. They're sitting in our basement waiting for Thanksgiving. I mailed some off to my parents who are not in New England for fall this year as a, like you said, mailing off when you're homesick, a reminder of what fall in New England really is.
Yeah. And I guess that's why I keep speaking of this as an iconic fruit, because it seems to pull at our heartstrings in a unique way. Because and part of it may be, just that it's a beautiful time of the year around here, and here's this whole process that takes place. Now, to get back to how has that changed? I mean, now you a lot of it hasn't changed, but you have much more modern equipment. And in addition to that, you now have these hybrids, which, I mean, the way, some of the cranberries are being hybridized, excuse me, today is literally taking the cranberry right back to, its DNA and trying to then pick and choose the DNA that you most want to put into the berry. And this is essentially to increase the yield. There is a particular very, very interesting, very experimental hybrid right now that's being developed to see if it can't be an answer to climate change. It will be more drought resistant. It will be able to withstand higher heats. But for the most part, these hybrids are for higher yield.
Hmm. Now, cranberry harvesting and cranberry bogs, for all of their historic value and our kind of nostalgia around them, have gotten a bit of a black eye in recent years, perhaps even recent decades, for perhaps not being very good for the environment, impacting herring runs, the use of pesticides, the use of water for these. What kinds of things are happening in the cranberry industry to try to not only just change the image, but actually change the impact of cranberry cultivation?
Well, I think I think that just about every grower wants to use something called best management practices, because he or she certainly doesn't want to, make an enemy of a neighbor or have someone hurt as a result of cranberry growing. And also, it can be a real threat to the industry because in 1959, there was no cranberry sauce at Thanksgiving because a particular herbicide was found in a shipment of cranberries from the West Coast. And so a man named Flemmy, who at that time was the head of health, education, and welfare, decided to ban all cranberries. And this was a week before Thanksgiving. So all of the grocery stores immediately removed cranberries from their shelves. And that was the first time, I think, that cranberries really got a bad name, because of what's put on the bogs. So I think right now, to go back to the best management practices, a responsible cranberry grower, I like to think they're responsible, is going to use a number of things, but he's going to use something called tailwater recovery system, and this is going to basically keep all the water on the bog within his control and his system, essentially. Mm-hmm. And what it is you have a storage area for the water, and that's hooked up to a whole irrigation system. As a result, you're not suddenly drawing on the aquifer that a lot of other people are sharing, and you also are minimizing the amount of leakage from anything that you might put on the bog out into waters that, beyond your cranberry bogs. Now, in addition to that, there's something called integrated pest management that all the growers that I've interviewed use. I mean, you see the pictures, and there's no question that many of these pesticides that were sprayed on the bogs around the early 60s were, I mean, they were aerial sprayed in some cases. Some of the some of these pesticides came out of World War II, you know, where people realized that if they had done such a great job with, you know, mosquitoes in the Pacific, why they may as, you know, why not spray them on cranberry bogs? Exactly. And other chemical combinations. But so out of that, you have, I mean, people realize this was horrible. You can't keep doing that. So integrated pest management basically is you have people who will go on a bog when it's in flower. And when the insects are first arriving, and they'll start, you know, they'll take one sample, and if they find that there's any insect on that, then they'll notify the grower that to do something, and the something probably will be as simple as just treating a tiny area of the bog. Then they'll see if that clears up the problem, or if there is then a larger area, you know, there are other areas right. that have been attacked. So you are limiting the overall damage from the pesticides, herbicides, whatever.
I was really interested to learn that, in fact, sanding the bogs and flooding the bogs mm-hmm. were practices that were originally intended as ways before we had pesticides
yes,
of
right.
controlling pests. And yeah. it's kind of, you know, interesting how things evolve. And then that flooding becomes part of the problem when you combine it with pesticides.
Right.
You know, the way things change. But that was originally the pest management scheme.
Exactly. And you have, I mean, I think if you take a look at the West Coast, you start to see that it becomes it behooves everyone to really, if they're going to grow cranberries, to find ways to grow them sustainably. And the reason I mention the West Coast is that you have something which is kind of between organic and conventionally harvested berries called sustainably harvested, but they're also sustainably grown. And they have to be because the bogs are just alongside some of the finest trout and salmon, mostly streams you're going to find anywhere. And these people have learned that by putting oils on the bogs as opposed to pesticides and various teas, and whenever they see any infestation, they can really minimize the loss to the grower without in any way damaging the environment. So I think I'd like to think that basically the majority of cranberry growers are trying to grow in highly responsible ways. And you have something, again, during President Lincoln's time, the various agricultural departments within colleges were formed, and in some cases the colleges themselves were agricultural. And even today you have a very fine experiment station in Wareham, and they are constantly putting out new ways for growers to treat the bogs in an environmentally sensitive way.
Okay, I have to ask you about the bounce test.
Okay.
is that just urban myth, or do they still bounce the cranberries to see which ones are the highest quality?
No, actually, it is still done. It isn't done everywhere anymore because there are mechanized ways of determining this. But when I first started researching this book, which actually was probably 7 years ago, I was invited to the processing facility at Ocean Spray in Lakeville, and they still had berries bouncing down.
Definitely my kids' favorite part of the whole cranberry collecting is to drop berries on the
exactly.
dining room table and watch them go everywhere.
Oh, they're even better with stairs.
Don't tell them that.
And that's how it started, actually, that a man with a wooden leg who was a cranberry grower in New Jersey kept his berries up on the loft, and it was a real hassle for him to get up on the ladder to get these berries down. So he one day, supposedly, some berries fell downstairs that, I guess he had stairs and a ladder, but he noticed that only the good ones bounced and the bad ones just fell to the side and rolled off.
That's fabulous. My guest is Susan Playfair. She's talking about her book, America's Founding Fruit, The Cranberry in a New Environment. More after a short break. You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest is Susan Playfair, author of the new book, America's Founding Fruit, The Cranberry in a New Environment. Unfortunately, the cranberry story is not all lighthearted at this point. Cranberry growers and cranberries themselves are facing some pretty significant challenges ahead from climate change. One of them, if we kind of move our way through the cranberry season, starting with blossoming in the spring, is that like many flowering plants, we're seeing the blossoming time, I guess, of cranberries moving later or earlier, I guess.
It would be earlier. Yeah. There are several potential problems. Obviously, right now, next year, you're not going to see cranberries all moving to Canada or south of Chile, picking themselves up. But when I started writing the book and I asked this question, you know, what was going to happen to this particular fruit? I mean, by inference, it was what was going to happen possibly to other fruit also. Now, in the case of the cranberry, it requires, I believe it's between about 1,700 and 2,000 chill hours in order to produce a fruit. And so over time, if you don't have those chill hours, this area becomes too warm so that that isn't possible, then cranberries won't be able to be grown here. And another issue is that right now you have insects and more dramatically fungus moving north as conditions warm. And the fungus are moving at four times the rate, in some cases, of insects. And actually, one of the things that cranberries are affected by negatively is there's a cranberry fungus. And then as going back to the insects, if the insects, which are moving at about the same rate as the climate is being seen to, or the planet is being seen to warm, if they suddenly are out of sync with the flowering of the cranberry, then you're either going to get different insects that might be attacking the berry, or more importantly, you'll find that the pollination for the berry, where you don't have bees that are arriving at the right time, is going to be affected. So there are a number of different conditions here that could be a threat to the cranberry continuing ad infinitum to grow in this area.
There's been a lot of attention toward bees. In recent years, the decline of bee populations. And I read something a few months ago that cranberry growers in New England haven't tended to use trucked-in bees brought in specifically to pollinate the cranberries. But about that same time, I went for a walk around the bogs near our house and snapped a bunch of photos of, it must have been four dozen beehives sitting on the edge of the bogs. Is that becoming a more common practice?
Yes, I think it is. What you have is honeybees and bumblebees here, and the bumblebees tend to be the native bee. Well, they're not really native, but that's, you have to read the book to find out more about that. But in any case, they're the ones that are native right now, wintering over. And the honeybees, in many cases, are the ones that are trucked up from southern areas usually. And of course, there's been a real scare because with colony collapse disorder, which no one fully understood and still doesn't entirely, I mean, no one still fully understands it. The concern was, well, if you have these bees that are out pollinating almonds and they're pollinating various other things and they're picking up who knows what from these other areas, we should be really careful about having them, you know, in this area. Now, I think it's fair to say that the growers right now are somewhat on the fence, and they're still using a lot of the honeybees that are nomadic. And at the same time, many people are trying to find ways to keep the bumblebees around the bogs, for instance, planting a lot of wildflowers so that they, when the flowering season is over for cranberries, there'll still be something for the bumblebees to eat, and clover. And it's a very careful balance because on the other hand, if you make it too attractive to the honeybees, they're not going to bother to go over and pollinate the cranberry flowers.
Right, right.
And actually that is a problem that one of the growers in Wisconsin I spoke to has. He has a large, very beautiful area that where he's got sandhill cranes there and all kinds of wildlife, but he also has something called a buckthorn bush, and I guess bees adore buckthorn bushes. So you have to have that perfect balance if you're going to keep the bumblebees, you know, pollinating these cranberries. And right now, there's a lot of experimentation going on, but there is still a reliance on the trucked-in bees.
Hmm. How much work is going on to try to, you've mentioned a little bit about the creating new hybrids, mm-hmm. some of the best management practices that address the environmental impacts could also perhaps help make the cranberries themselves and that the cultivation process more resilient to climate change. How much work is going on in that space right now?
There may be more work than I know of, to be honest. But I guess the only thing I know of at the moment is really just trying to produce a berry that can be more adaptable. And what's happening, on the other hand, is that an ocean spray has done this in a large way, is that independent growers and the cooperative have been hedging their bets by buying land in New Brunswick. Ocean Spray just bought out this large company in Chile that was growing berries. So they're a big reason, as I understand it, that they've done that is because they are interested in the Chinese market, and this gives them a an immediately easy way of shipping to China. And then there are duty issues. Also, but as far as I know, there isn't anything else I've heard about other than trying to create a berry that is more adaptable.
What do we lose? I mean, you're talking about buying land in Canada. From the industry perspective, they can find somewhere else to grow cranberries. From the consumer's perspective, they would still be able to get cranberries. Mm-hmm. What do we here in New England and as a nation lose if New England is no longer a suitable home for cranberries?
Well, that's a great question, since I have a perfect quote from a grower about that in the book. But, however, I think that, you can say, well, this is not as serious an issue as, you know, the land that's being lost every day in Louisiana, the marshes, or the birds that are disappearing as a result of climate change. But I think that even though we will be able to continue to buy cranberries when they're grown in Canada or they're grown somewhere else, I think something uniquely American will be lost. And that's perhaps being very patriotic, but it just seems that this is something that we do like to go down and see it grown, and we do like to think that it's ours. So
I think that touches on something that talking with a lot of climate scientists about many of the different impacts of climate change that we are beginning to feel and will feel, that there is more than simply as important as it is, the physical realities of how the world will be different. But the fact that climate change has the ability to impact our sense of identity and our psyche.
No, I totally agree.
What concerns you more? And we'll stick to cranberries here. Okay. You mentioned in the book the societal shift away from agriculture, from engagement with agriculture or appreciation of agriculture. And clearly you come from a family where cultivation of cranberries is a family tradition as well as a national heritage. What concerns you more, that societal shift away from agriculture or these physical and climatological changes that threaten cranberries? Or can the two not really be separated?
I'm not sure it's possible to make to state a preference, because it seems to me that it's an interdependent relationship here. So obviously I'm more if we were to lose cranberries but there would be no climate change, I'd be all for not having the climate change and losing the cranberry. Especially if I could still buy them when they were grown in Canada. But aside from that, I mean, I think that in telling this story, I was trying to tell a bigger story, which is, maybe we don't all agree on what it might be that causes climate change, but it seems to me that we have to pay attention to the fact that it's definitely affecting, birds, animals, trees, plants, flowers, agriculture. And so these are things that, even though it may be simple to say, but they're things that we hold really dear, and we don't want them to change. We like to see certain things stay the same, and I think that's true. I don't think you have to be older to feel that. I think that many young people like to see things stay the same also.
Let's end on a lighter note without going through, tablespoons and cups. Give us the gist of your favorite cranberry recipe.
I will give you the easiest cranberry recipe.
That's also good.
Which is, and I'm going to make it easy. So you don't even have to, you can make this more complicated by making your own pie crust, but you can make a cranberry banana pie by purchasing a pie crust, mashing some bananas, getting a can and a half of chunky cranberry sauce, adding some gelatin, and gelatin which you've warmed,
right.
Putting it into mixing it all together, putting it into the pie crust, and waiting for the gelatin to set. And then you can either slice some decorative bananas on the top, or you can put some whipped cream on top, and you have a perfect dessert.
I've tried apple cranberry pie. Never banana cranberry banana pie. I will have to try that one.
And I strongly suggest that if you are concerned about sugar in your cranberry juice, as you should be, why you make your own cranberry juice, and you can then put in as much or as little sugar as you want.
Susan Playfair, thank you, and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, Heather.
Susan Playfair is author of the new book, America's Founding Fruit, The Cranberry in a New Environment. You can find more information about America's Founding Fruit, plus some of our favorite cranberry recipes on our website, capeandislands.org. Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. We have some gorgeous cranberry photos for you this week. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.